From the Firebird Radio Studio, it's the Authors on Fire podcast with nationally syndicated radio host and producer, Pat Rulo.
Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network, home of the Firebird Book Awards, the Positive Change Podcast Awards Hall of Fame, our newest book song, where we create a unique one-of-a-kind song just for your book, and this podcast, Authors on Fire. I am Pat Rulo. Today's guest is someone who has spent her career refusing false choices between rigor and creativity, scholarship and storytelling, success and meaning. Patricia Levy is a novelist, sociologist, and one of the world's leading voices in arts-based research. She has published more than 50 books across fiction and nonfiction, received well over 100 awards, and helped redefine what knowledge can look and feel like. Her latest book and most recent Firebird Book Award winner, titled The Artist Academic, is part memoir, part guide, and entirely honest about building a career that doesn't just look good on paper, but feels right in the body. Welcome back, my dear friend, Patricia Levy.
Oh, thank you so much for having me and for that beautiful introduction. The way you describe my work truly makes me smile. So thank you for your kind words.
Well, it's easy. How's that? It's easy when it comes to you. And I say this all the time, but congratulations on winning the Firebird Book Award for The Artist Academic.
Thank you so much. And I have to tell you, it really means a lot to me. And, you know, I think sometimes people think, well, if you've received multiple awards, maybe it doesn't mean as much. But each book is its own labor and project and usually takes years. And The Artist Academic is my first memoir. So I've never done this kind of writing before. And I published it under my own publishing imprint. So for all of those reasons, I was just over the moon that it would receive any recognition at all. So I'm truly honored.
You are so humble. And it goes to, often it goes to completely different judges who may or may not have read your previous works. So be assured that each book is standalone. It's read by independent people and judged that way and not as a block of your work.
Well, that's amazing. And it's also amazing when you look at all of the award recipients and you see so many people doing interesting, creative, important work. And it's just wonderful to be included in that group.
My pleasure. You, my friend, have had an extraordinary career, scholar, novelist, award-winning research, and now you've written The Artist Academic. If someone picked up your book expecting a traditional memoir or a standard career guide, how would you surprise them? Tell us, what is this book really?
So, okay, I'll tell you the reason that I wrote this book. Over the years, when I've been at book talks, conferences, doing keynote addresses, sort of, you know, traveling the world as an author, people at all career levels, from students to like full professors and well-published authors, basically always ask me the same thing. They ask me some version of, how did you do it? And sometimes they make that more specific. So, you know, how did you develop a successful academic career or a career as an author and novelist? How did you leave academia to go independent? How did you bridge academic and popular work? How did you find audiences for both novels and academic texts? All kinds of questions, but really I tend to think that by it, they usually mean, how did you build the life and career that you want? And how might I do the same thing? And so I wrote this book to try to answer that question that I've been asked so much. And so I take a really honest, deep dive into my career. You know, I start in childhood. I don't spend a ton of time there, but just where the seeds of creativity were planted, what my dreams and aspirations were, who some of my big influences were. And then really the rest of the book is chapter by chapter about my career, becoming an academic, becoming an author, becoming an arts-based researcher and novelist and sort of pushing on the borders of academia, ultimately leaving academia. And in the book, I talk about these messy gut checks and how they lead to turning points. And those messy gut checks are like when, you know, you feel in your gut, in your heart, in your soul, that something isn't quite right, that you're not fulfilling your purpose, your heart's desire. And for me, it was not a function of having a failing career, which for some people it is that. And that could be a wonderful opportunity too, because if something's not working, there's a reason why. Maybe it's not the thing you should be doing or with that those people or at that time. But for me, it was more a function of I had a career that looked really great on paper, but it didn't feel great. And I wanted a life that didn't just look good, but a life that actually felt good. And so I started engaging with these, like, you know, messy gut checks, like just getting really honest with myself. And each time I did that, it led to a turning point. It led me to make a different choice, to try something different, to take a risk. Some of those things worked out and some of them didn't. I mean, in the book, I talk about all of my missteps, mistakes I made, bad things that other players might have done at different times, things I wish I had done differently. But you put it all together and I really forged my own path and I am absolutely living the career and the life I want to live. And in addition to all that sort of stuff about my career, I also do offer advice. So, you know, there's a chapter about building a profile as an artist academic or just as an author, a writer, a creative. It doesn't really matter what you do. So I talk about how you can use social media, build a website, gain a following, all these different kinds of things. So it's why I call it a professional memoir and a guidebook, because I really try to do both, give this honest account of my own career, but pull out the lessons and then sort of expand on those lessons so that it would be more useful for readers.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So it's more than a title. It's an identity that you had to claim in spaces that often resist hybridity. Was there a moment when you realized I'm not trying to fit in anymore? I'm building my own lane?
Yes. I mean, I don't know if it was a moment or moments, but you're spot on. I think the world in general, so it's not just academia and the arts, but in general, people want to put everybody into an easily defined category. Mm-hmm. And we like people to stay in their lane. And we structure, you know, we structure the workplace that way. We definitely structure academia that way. Even the way disciplines are organized, it's not really about how researchers study topics and how professors teach topics. It's much more about just organizing like work life in a way that's easy to define. And I mean, I was doing an Instagram live last night that it was about my forthcoming novel, but we were talking about how, you know, authors are often encouraged if they write in more than one genre to use different pen names for the different genres. And I just never did any of that. I sort of figured out early on that I was maybe not going to fit in the traditional way. And I really never had my whole life. I mean, I was very, very shy as a child. I was bullied very badly when I was young, which made me more shy. And so I always had this feeling my entire life that I don't really fit in. And when I was in graduate school, I loved graduate school. I mean, I loved learning. I loved my professors. I loved my peers. I loved the whole experience. But I definitely felt like my ideas and where I wanted to go in my mind was definitely going to be working on the margins. It was not going to be the mainstream. And so I just sort of accepted early on that, you know, my career might look different than other people's career. And that's okay. And when my book, Method Meets Art, came out in 2008, and that was the first methods book about arts-based research. And arts-based research is when researchers in any field use the arts to conduct and or to share their research to make it more accessible. And when I wrote that book in 2008, there was nothing else like it. And, you know, a lot of people thought I was crazy, like to like hang my hat on what people saw as a thing that doesn't really exist or a fad or a trend. But that book changed my whole life. It became my first bestseller. It's been translated around the world. It's taken me around the world with it. It's, you know, over 15 years later, it's still a bestseller for my publisher. It's in its third edition. It's going into its fourth edition. So if I had listened to the naysayers, basically, this wonderful part of my life would not have happened. So I just learned early on that you have to take in feedback from people you respect. You have to sort of anticipate what some of the critique might be. And then you have to forge ahead anyway, because life is short. And, you know, being an insider is not always the greatest thing in the world if you have to sacrifice who you are to accomplish it. So I just made the decision I wasn't going to do that. And then I will tell you, in 2011, when I published my first novel, which was called Low Fat Love, and to me, it was both research and a novel that you could read as a beach read because it was loosely based on my research for a decade. When I released that, I knew, like, this is it. This is the path I am walking. I am an artist academic, come what may.
So as I listen to you, it makes me think that arts-based research asks people to take emotion, embodiment, and imagination seriously as knowledge. If I'm right, what kind of knowing do the arts make possible, perhaps that traditional scholarship simply can't access?
It's a wonderful question. Thank you for that. And I will say, you know, I am a proponent of traditional scholarship too. So for those listening, you know, because you validate and legitimate one way of knowing doesn't mean everything else is illegitimate. It just means things, different approaches are good for different things. I mean, if, you know, your toilet is broken, you're not going to grab your hammer because that's the wrong tool. You probably need a wrench or whatever. So, you know, we have different tools. So the arts, I mean, we all know this from our personal lives. Like, think about when you go to a movie and you laugh or you cry, the story lingers, sometimes for hours, sometimes for days, weeks, or years. When you read a novel that you get really immersed in and you have an emotional response and you remember it. When you listen to music, and if you're lucky to do that in community, so you go to a concert and, you know, the band or singer you love comes out and there is just electricity in that entire space and everybody there is feeling it. And it's like you are all transported listening to this music that you love. These are just experiences we have with the arts that we don't have with nonfiction prose. Like, you don't have that same experience reading a newspaper article or listening to statistics or watching the news. And part of it is because it is embodied. We feel it in all parts of ourselves. It's linked to our heart and our feelings. There's actually neuroscience behind it. So there's actually something physiological that happens when we consume art. And when we feel really immersed, it's not just like a feeling per se. There is a physiological thing happening where different regions in our brain are activated in a way that they aren't with nonfiction prose, for example. So we really are having an immersive experience. And that can lead to empathy. It can lead to challenging stereotypes. It can lead to jarring us to think about something differently. It can lead to compassion. It can lead to just learning about a topic or people. So it can lead to many, many things that we value. And it doesn't have to replace other kinds of knowing, but the arts are a very valid form of knowing. And the truth is that most academic research never reaches the public. It circulates in journals that people don't have access to and wouldn't be able to read or understand even if they did. And they are boring as anything, including the ones I've written. So nobody really wants to engage in that stuff. But how do people want to spend their time? They want to watch a movie. They want to listen to music. They want to go to a play. You know, you can go to any museum and you will see there are certain paintings that always have a crowd around them. As you know, I travel to New York a lot. I'm a big New York fan. And there are some places, like I have a membership at the MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art. And whenever you go and see Van Gogh's Starry Night, there is a crowd around it. So people choose to spend their time engaged in the arts. People elect to do that. And to me, that means there's enormous potential for education, research, and learning.
And I love all of your social media posts because you feed your art soul through your travel and dining experiences and museums. And yeah, you live that life and are so embodied in that, that it just permeates who you are and then out into your writing.
Thank you. I feel so lucky for the life that I have created and that I am able to live at the moment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but again, it's why I wrote the book, because people ask, like, well, how do you do all this travel? Well, one of the ways I do this travel is because my books get me invitations to different places. And then I take full advantage of that. Mm-hmm. And I enjoy the sights and the art and the food and everything that fills my soul. And the reason I share so much of it on my social media is to inspire other people, but also to share it with people who might not be able to go to those places or experience those things. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we can all work on creating more of those opportunities for ourselves if that's something we want to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, you are an inspiration. And half those meals, I would love to join you.
Oh, I am a foodie. My husband makes fun of me that I'm such a foodie and I take pictures. But it's like the food is so beautiful. And I feel like if you're not here, like I would share it with everyone if I could. But since I can't do that, I can share the photograph.
Oh, and that is art in and of itself. Truly. Some of those, the way they plate the meal.
Oh my God. So beautiful. It's absolutely an art form. I mean, sometimes I don't even want to bite into it.
Eat it.
It's so gorgeous.
I love that. So you have helped countless scholars rethink legitimacy. You mentioned legitimacy earlier. How do you personally decide when a project needs credentials and when it needs courage?
Oh, what a wonderful question. I mean, I am a big believer that people should start from where they are. And you can build credentials as you go, but if you don't have all the credentials you think you need, it shouldn't stop you from doing the work you want to do. I really, really believe that. And, you know, sometimes the best work comes from novices. Sometimes the best work comes from graduate students. In my book, Method Meets Art, which I mentioned earlier, after every chapter, I include an exemplar. So a published bit of research using that art form, so visual art, theater, whatever it might be. And I have several examples that I've used in every edition from graduate students. And I do that on purpose to show that at all levels, people can do interesting and engaging work. And so while there is something to be said about, you know, the value of cumulative knowledge and wisdom that you develop over time, there's also something to be said for, you know, having fresh eyes and looking at something with excitement. And so I think it's important to have the courage to try new things, even when you might not be great at it yet, and then to get the credentials. So to work on your craft, to do the research, to get the education, but you can do that as you go. I mean, I am more than 50 books in and I work on my craft as a writer every day. I hope that the last book I wrote is, you know, better than two books ago. I hope the next book I write will be better than the last one. So there is no shame in growing. That is a beautiful, beautiful part of being a creative and being a human being. And so, you know, if you are a creative and you have any kind of output, whether it's nonfiction, fiction, visual art, whatever it is, you will see your evolution as you look at that output over the course of your career. And sometimes, like when I look back, I see, you know, a book of mine that I might think is mediocre, it wasn't great, I didn't really know what I was doing, but there are some glimmers or something beautiful that I actually couldn't recreate now because I would know too much and I would do it the right way instead of maybe the magical way. Mm-hmm. So I think we should just work from where we are and always strive to get better and know more. And, you know, it's like that famous quote by Maya Angelou, when you know better, you do better. So I think that's true, but I think we need courage along the entire way. And courage is not the absence of fear. Courage is pushing through, even if you're afraid.
Wow. Yes, absolutely. And talking about courage just leads me to another thought. You have experienced misogyny and abuse in professional spaces. What doesn't get talked about enough, I don't think, is how that reshapes creativity itself. So for you, how did those experiences change the way you protect or maybe even weaponize your creativity now?
Thank you for such a great question. So, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I have had a lot of negative experiences, which I think, you know, unfortunately, I think that's true for most women creatives. And you don't have to be a woman. I mean, some of these issues, they just permeate and it doesn't matter who you are, you might face these issues. So I've done a couple of things. I mean, first of all, I've seen how some of the book contracts I have signed have not protected me in very real pragmatic ways. And I've seen that when there's a problem, I was not properly protected. And so I have completely transformed the way I negotiate book contracts, what I will and will not sign. I went back to one of my publishers, this is years ago now, but I was having a huge problem with them. They were in a a state of serious dysfunction beyond my work, but it was affecting me deeply. And I renegotiated all my previous contracts and got the rights back to my entire catalog and basically turned them into my distributor. So they were just the distributor for my books. But at that point, I was the owner. And that changed my mindset. It changed my life in very, very real ways. And, you know, years ago, I used to take some of my battles to social media and those kinds of spaces. But at some point, I stopped doing that for the most part. Every once in a while, if there's some social issue I think I just have to speak out about, I will. But for the most part, I feel like those are not positive spaces to sort of broadcast troubles. I don't think you really change people's mind. I don't think you necessarily even inform and educate people. I think it's just like become a dumping ground. So instead, I turn to my books. So in my novels, for example, there will be toxic characters. There will be misogynist characters. There will be racism, whatever the issue is that I want to address, that these are real world issues. And, you know, it's not just because I've experienced them. It's because many people have experienced them, or I've observed other people experiencing them. So I sort of, you know, I always say the one place I will never compromise is in my books. And that is true. So I definitely have situations in some of my novels that have been inspired by some of the negative situations and negative players I've had to deal with. And I feel like it's, for me, the best way to address those issues, because I feel like in a novel format, it can resonate and come across to people in just a completely different way. And I have a lot of readers who will read one of my books and say, gee, like, that happened to me too, or that happened to me, but I didn't know it happened to other people, or now I know what to do if that happens to me, or I didn't realize this was a thing. And so that is all extremely affirming that it, you know, it has its place. And I have to say, and this is like my lower self, but it is true, Pat, and I try to be honest, is that it can make me feel pretty good too, in a way, like, you know, it's like a checkmate. It's like, you know, you put me through a miserable situation and maybe I didn't go public about it at the time, but when the time comes, something will go across one of the pages of my novels and I know where it came from. Mm-hmm. And that makes me feel like, you know, that is my win. I take that as my win, that I have the freedom to write what I want to write. And if there are bad actors out there and they get called out in that way, well, maybe they shouldn't have behaved as bad actors.
That is brilliant. I love everything you said, because I so agree with that when I see some of the social media posts that are just ugly, really, and it's not serving that author very well. It's not going to change anybody's mind or behavior. And now that's what you attribute to that author. And whereas, as you're saying, you could take all of that and put it into your writing and, you know, create something where you actually might influence or teach somebody rather than calling out yourself. I just think that's such a brilliant answer. Thank you.
Well, it's great because you do get to get it off your chest, mm-hmm. but you also get to spread the message you want to spread. It is cathartic and it is a motivator. I mean, every bad thing that's ever happened to me in my life has motivated me to do something that turned out into a positive in my life. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's not immediate. You know, sometimes it takes a long time depending on what you're processing. But all the bad things, you know, it's, you know, look, you don't wish bad things upon yourself or anyone else, but at the same time, you really can't go back and wish to change any of it, because it all brings you to where you are and to who you are. And I'm grateful for what I'm able to do now and the way I'm able to do it. And so I know some of those bad experiences are a part of that, including just that, you know, I own the majority of my catalog of work, which is something that actually would not have happened had I not had negative experiences that at the time, you know, were soul crushing, but ultimately led me to a better place.
Absolutely. Oh, wow. Congratulations.
Thank you.
It's a great conversation. Here's one for you. I was thinking about creativity almost as a form of caretaking, whether it be taking care of ideas or stories or even people. What do you feel most responsible for protecting as a writer?
What an amazing question. You come up with the best questions, Pat. Nobody has ever asked me that before. And I have an answer. So I've actually spent a lot of time thinking about this. And I've thought about it over the course of my whole career. But in 2025, I lost three of my dearest souls. And it was just an incredibly difficult year with a lot of grief. And, you know, two of those three deaths were totally unexpected. So it was a very hard year. And I thought a lot about it. And really, what the reason my novels are important to me is not because I think that anything I have to say or express is necessarily so important. I mean, I really don't. However, all of the lessons I have learned from every important person throughout my entire life, starting in childhood, are in those books. And that is important. All the people that I have loved and that have loved me, all the people that have imparted some wisdom on me, many people who are no longer on this planet, but who made a lifelong impression on me and changed something about the way I think or see or feel, all of those people, their wisdom walks across the pages of those books. It is there. Nobody will ever know it but me. Nobody will ever know those details but me, but I know where all those pearls of wisdom are. And I know they did not come from me. They came from all these other wonderful people who have been in my life who maybe did not have the ability to express themselves the same way. Maybe they did not write books or do something else. And so that is what I feel like I am a guardian for. It is their wisdom, their legacy, their love. And I see that in every single book I write. I know where I got certain things. I know where I learned them. I know who made that impression. I know where I got that bit of wisdom. And so I honor all of those important people in my life, in my books. And for that reason, I feel like it's important for me to write. And my novels are important because I want to preserve the things that they knew and that they taught me.
What a beautiful legacy, whether your readers know it or not, you do.
Thank you.
Now, your turn toward romance probably surprised some people, but it feels deeply aligned with your lifelong work. What did stepping into romance give back to you as an artist?
I have to say, I love it more than anything I've done in my entire life, like literally anything. I mean, the first romance novel I wrote, it only took me 10 days to do the first draft, which is like insane. It should take a lot longer to write a book. And the reason is because this is what I'm supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. And I think I had suppressed it for so long for many different reasons that when I decided to do it, it just poured out of me. And I can tell you that whenever I am writing a love story, those are the days where I end up like my stomach is growling and I look at the clock and I'm like, oh my God, it's like 3 p.m. and I haven't eaten. Like, you know, that's what all artists want. You want to be in flow. You want the magic. And of course, it's a lot of discipline. Being an author, it's discipline. It's writing even when you're not in flow. But since becoming a romance novelist, I spent a lot more of my life in that amazing space of flow. And I just love it because really what it is I am spending my days immersed in these worlds filled with love and compassion and empathy. That's what my romance novels are all about. They all have good aspirational characters. There's no toxic relationships. If there's bad players, they are like off the page. So they are people who cause trauma or abuse or grief, but they are not the central characters. So it's just like being immersed in the best of the human race, Pat. Like that is honestly how I feel. And there's so much negativity in the world and there are so many really difficult, horrible things happening and happening in this specific moment, but always that are happening. And so to spend most of your time immersed in a world where like the dominant theme is love and care is just an amazing, amazing thing. So it's been very healing for me. It's been very cathartic. It's been the most prolific time in my career. I've written more since I started writing romance novels about 5 or 6 years ago. maybe 6 or 7 years ago now, I'm losing track. But since whenever I started, I've written more books since then, and more books that I just deeply, deeply love than I had in my entire career before that. So I definitely feel like I've stepped into my purpose. And I think when we do that, we feel it on a deep soul level. And not everybody can do that as their full-time job. And I totally understand that. There are practical constraints. But if you can step into your purpose to whatever capacity you're able to, I do feel like you really feel it. You feel like you're plugged into something. You feel like you're living your best life. And I do feel like, you know, if you're doing work that touches your heart, it is very likely it is going to do that for somebody else.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. Talking about stepping into your purpose. And, you know, that sounds easy and it is doable, but talking to our listeners here, what would be the first small, honest question that one should ask themselves as they head in that direction?
I suggest that everybody write a letter to themselves. Nobody else is ever going to see it. This is completely private. And I really suggest you write a letter and not just think it, because when you put something down on paper, you literally actually move it to a different part of your brain. So there's actually like neuroscience behind this. But aside from that, you are taking something and you are making it real in a different way. So I suggest everybody take the time to write themselves a letter and be 100% honest and unfiltered about what is your life right now and what do you want your life to be? So what is it? Like, just be honest about what it is that, and that can be your career, but it doesn't only have to be your career. It can be any aspect of your life. So what is it? And then write, and what would you really like it to be? Like, if you could have your dream scenario, and the dream scenario should not be to win $1 billion in the lottery. Right. It should be like, actually, how do you want to spend your time every day? And then take a look at that and look at that and see the gap between where you are and where you want to be. That is a messy gut check. And if you do that, you absolutely will get led to a turning point. Like, I believe that to the core of my soul, because you will be confronted with the truth of the gap between your life as it is and your life as you want it to be. And then you have a choice to start taking steps towards closing that gap. And that's what I did. And it wasn't just one time. Like, you don't have to change your entire life overnight. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book. I did not change my entire life overnight. There were many different phases where I asked myself hard questions. And then I made one change, took one risk, made one decision. And all of that ultimately led me to the life that I wanted.
Mm-hmm. Okay, folks, messy gut checks to close the gap. How's that? My friend, Patricia, anything we missed as we begin to wrap up?
No, I just want to say thank you. You truly ask the best questions. And so, you know, my hope is that people do write that letter to themselves. And if they're interested in the book, The Artist Academic is available on Amazon in all formats. And really, if anybody does read the book, I hope they read it to learn less about me and just get more inspired about their own lives, because our lives are precious. They are fleeting. Time is not unlimited. Our creativity is also precious and should be protected. And so, you know, I would love to live in a world where everybody is, you know, carving their own path and living their best life and really feeling their purpose.
Oh, well, I think this conversation today will help those in addition to reading your book. So thank you so much. If you would give us your contact information, I know you can get your books on Amazon, your website, or any other place you want to send us.
So please, you can visit patricialevy.com. Levy is L-E-A-V-Y. So patricialevy.com. And there's links to many of my books, links to all my social media. And I do respond to folks. So if people send me DMs, you will get a response from me. And I would love to see you online.
Yes, you are extremely responsive. So that is the truth. Patricia Levy, her work reminds us that careers aren't just built, they're lived. The Artist Academic isn't a formula for success. It's an invitation to listen more closely to your own turning points, gut checks, and quiet knowing. Patricia, this is a conversation I know that can change people as your words and your book show us to trust that meaning often comes from choosing what feels true and not just what looks impressive. Thank you once again for joining me, and this conversation today is just so inspiring. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Pat. It was a great conversation.